Listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. It's 5 o'clock on Tuesday, so it's time for Office Hour. So welcome to Office Hour. This is Naomi Janowitz, otherwise known as Professor J on the radio. And as we do every Tuesday at 5, first we remind you that the views that are presented in the show may not reflect the views of the KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. And now that we have reminded you of that, we get to do what we do, is go and knock. Here we're knocking. We're going to knock on someone's door, and we're going to find out what is it that these people do all day in these buildings. Hot days like today when they're happy to be indoors. What are they thinking about? What are they studying? What are they researching? What can we learn from them? What can we learn about what happens on campus? And I'm very excited today because we're going into a slightly different end of the world. And we're going to be talking today with Dan Sperling. Get ready because it's a long title. Dan Sperling is the Blue Planet Prize Professor of Engineering and Environmental Science and Policy and the founding director of the UC Davis Institute of Transportation Studies, as well as distinguished professor, as we said, in civil engineering and environmental science and policy. So welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Right. And one of the secrets is that I used to carpool with Dan many years ago before I switched to Amtrak. And little did I know, I was carpooling with an expert in carpooling. So that's what we're going to learn today. Anybody out there, have you gone anywhere today in this heat? Have you gone out? Have you gotten in a car? Have you gotten on a bicycle? Have you gotten on one of those new scooters that are parked around campus or any of these other modes of transportation? That's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be looking into the future. Whatever you did today may not be what you do in a decade. So and I love to talk about this as somebody who owns an electric car and has brought it to campus and tried to charge and all kinds of things we want to learn from Dan today. But before we begin on his particular area of research, we're going to do what we always do at the beginning of Office Hour. And we're going to ask, you know, how does someone, you know, wake up one day and decide traffic, cars? I want to study how cars get into traffic. You know, how did you come to be a specialist in these questions of transportation studies?
Well, it was a little roundabout way. I was actually born on a chicken farm in upstate New York.
Oh, okay.
As far away from this world as one can imagine. Except this is an Aggie campus. That's about the only connection. And I just grew up on a farm. I went to university. They told me I was smart in math. I should study engineering. Hated engineering. So I wandered around, learned about social change, economics, environment, went into Peace Corps.
Where'd you go? Just curious.
I was in Honduras.
Honduras in the Peace Corps.
Yeah. It was a lot more peaceful there at that time. Now they're having a lot of problems with gangs.
Right.
And I was a city planner there. I mean, I didn't know much about city planning. I learned a lot more than they did. But I came back and worked then for the US EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. And I really started to realize that in my life, what I like to do is connect the dots. I like to understand how things work in the real world. And I saw how bad off people are in places like Honduras. I saw how bad the environment is. I saw how bad transportation was. And so I wanted to connect the dots. And I went to grad school, Berkeley.
In what department were you in?
I was in the transportation engineering program in civil engineering.
So by the time you got to grad school, after your experience there, you were pretty much focused on transportation as the key to a lot of social problems.
When I went to grad school, because I had been studying environment, I actually focused on Nevada. I used to go to Nevada a week a month for my job at the Environmental Protection Agency on water. I thought, man, they're really screwing this up. Everyone's screwing it up. The government is screwing it up. The people are screwing it up. I want to work in something where I can really help people. So I thought I'd study mass transit. Well, that wasn't the answer, but that's what got me. And then I connected up with energy. Those were the days when there were OPEC. It was right after the OPEC embargo. I know I'm really old. and Jimmy Carter and synthetic fuels. And I was all kind of looking around saying, you know, things are not working. Uh-huh. There has to be a better way to do it.
Okay.
And then, you know, the rest is history.
The rest is history. Well, I always like to pause here and just remind our listeners, particularly our student listeners, how many people have influential experiences when they go abroad. So you heard it yet again today, the foundational experience of getting out of California. We have a very big educational abroad program. Maybe it's time for us to get on a plane and go away and have experience and see how things work in the rest of the world. So with this idea that you wanted to have a positive impact, I think the place for us to start to understand what the future is to start with the present. And when I read over your articles about the present and the future of transportation, I was quite struck by several sort of facts about where we are today. And I'd sort of like to for us to outline what you think are some of the things that are sort of the groundwork discussion. One of them was the decline in public transit. I thought that was just really a fascinating statistic. We just don't seem to be able to raise the use of public transit. Do you have a theory as to why that is? It's the inconvenience? Is it just lifestyle? Is it just habit? Or why do you think we have so much trouble getting people to take public transit?
Well, it's more related to the attractions of the car and the fact that in California, at least, we built our state, our cities around the car, i.e. a lot of sprawled land use. And so transit doesn't work well in those places. Mm-hmm. The only place it works well in California is downtown San Francisco, really. Maybe the Davis campus.
So what we find is that it doesn't matter even if people like transit. And one of the things several of your articles mentioned is that people generally have a positive, warm, fuzzy feeling about public transit in order that they're willing to keep funding it. But there's a big difference between having a fuzzy feeling and living in a world that's just not structured well for public transit.
Well, there's substantial research that shows that fuzzy feeling is really people saying, if more people would just go on the buses and get out of their cars, I'll have less traffic congestion for me. Seriously.
Yeah.
That is probably explains more the voting behavior, because almost everywhere in the U.S. and California, people vote for these bonds and these sales tax increases. They tax themselves for transportation where most of the money is intended for mass transit. You know, on the face of it, it seems really illogical.
Because they're not actually intending to use it.
Right.
But I think it's a very deep insight. They're hoping their neighbors will start to use that public transit. And if their neighbor ever wanted to and they hadn't funded it, their neighbor wouldn't do it. And so therefore, they're stuck. So one of the facts is that the structure, the whole way that the state is built, doesn't support public transit. And we're just not going to be able to hold on to that as the great hope for the future. So I think that's really interesting. Some of the other...
Wait a minute. I'm not agreeing with that.
Oh, okay.
There is hope, but the hope has to do with these new forms of mobility that can be used to provide what we call first and last mile. It's like if you have a light rail or train or Amtrak, if we have a good way of getting to the station and away from it, then we're more willing to use it. And so if transit pulls back a little bit and operates where it operates well, in dense areas, dense corridors, where there's a lot of people going from one place to another, then it works very well. Mm-hmm. But most people are not going just from one place, one spot to another.
One transit stop to another transit
right.
stop, because they don't live on one transit stop and work on another transit stop.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So that's the future. So we'll get into this.
I want to get a couple more of the facts down. What are sort of the facts of the situation today? What you would say is a fact is that people are not likely to give up their cars, that may be too pie in the sky to think we're going to get a lot of people people are not willing to give up cars per se as a mode of transportation, even though they may be willing to move to sharing cars a little bit better. Would that be a good way of summarizing it?
Not exactly, because I would say the goal should be for people to give up cars, at least to give up personal ownership.
Cars. Right.
They'll still use cars and vans for almost all of their travel. But I think it's a reasonable, attainable goal that people will give up personal car ownership. And I'll kind of just the hint on that is it is when those cars are automated and relatively inexpensive.
I want to go over that just a little bit again, because the question is, you're saying that cars will still be here, but they won't be individually owned cars, or they might be slightly redesigned cars. Because I do think that is important when we fantasize about the future. Some people, again, in a fantasy, might have the idea that a car in any form is not part of the future solution for transportation. And you're saying, no, that it's not like we're going to have little weird jetpacks on our back or things that fly in the sky and pick us up. We're still basically talking, you know, because that's very much how the structure of our state was built, the structure of a lot of places are built, that we're still basically talking about car-like things are going to be in the future.
Right. So there's billions of dollars now being invested in these little small planes that are actually automated and electric. They just hold like two people and they'll just fly, you know, from one end of the metropolitan area to another. And so there's some kind, and of course, there's Elon Musk with some of his crazy ideas as well. I hope he's not listening. He's already gotten upset at things I've done. but in the end, yes, that's exactly right. Something that looks like a today's car is almost definitely going to be the how we move around in cities for a very, very long time.
Are there any other what you would call sort of baseline facts before we start to sort of imagine the future that kind of shape the basis of debate, of our thinking? I mean, if you would sort of giving students a these are the things you have to work with within your parameter of thinking that you think are sort of really important for us understanding the current facts of transportation.
Well, there's a couple. You know, one is traffic congestion, despite all the roads we've built, is getting worse and worse.
Okay.
At the same time, the amount of greenhouse gases from our vehicles is getting worse and worse. And the cost of vehicles is getting higher. And so lots of people can't and don't drive. Some can't drive for physical reasons. Others don't have the economic means to drive. And they're marginalized. Mm-hmm. And so somehow we have to create a society that is more accessible to more people than what we have now. And the current system is just not working well, even for the people that can afford it.
Okay, so one of the other issues is that much like getting more people to go on public transit, traffic seems to be almost something you can't solve right now. With the way that we're thinking and working, nothing has solved the traffic problem. I just want to pause for a minute and think about in this sort of current situation, the things that have failed to solve these problems. And one of them that I think of immediately is trying to have high occupancy car lanes. And what you're saying is that those have not currently solved the problem of traffic. We put a lot of those in, and guess what? You pull onto the highway, it's the same mess it was before they put those lanes on. So that kind of thinking, just to give you your listeners, if that's the way you're thinking, listeners, it's not going to work, right? So that's one of the problems, right?
So people will not on their own voluntarily share rides. We've seen that unless something changes. But given current vehicles and way of getting around, carpooling has largely failed. It went from 20% of people that commuted to work 40 years ago, you were in a carpool, and now that's down to 10%, even though, as you just said, we built all these carpool lanes.
Okay, so carpooling is off the table. And then another important thing you said is sort of a current fact is that there are many people for whom driving is really not accessible. So we also have a system set up that doesn't really meet everybody's needs. Okay, so everybody's got, so that's the kind of the area in which we're now thinking. So the question is, given all of that, how do we move forward with all of keeping all of those pretty complicated facts going at the same time? How can we work within those parameters to try to improve something? We're going to have to do something that's different. So what you're arguing for is you're talking about AV, automatic vehicles that drive themselves, and electrification. So help us understand how that is going to help us with these questions in the future.
Okay, so I'll lay out the kind of the goal, the end state. And so I wrote this book called Three Revolutions, Steering Automated, Shared, and Electric Vehicles to a Better Future. So that kind of summarizes it. So you nailed two of them, but the third one is sharing.
Sharing,
you know, the
right.
sharing economy. I refer to it as pooling because people kind of have a lot of different definitions and mean a lot of different things when they say sharing. What I mean by it is you have more than one person in a vehicle, mm-hmm. and ideally more than that. And I do tag on to that the what we now call micromobility, and that's the scooters and the bikes.
Right.
So the end state here, the goal that we're looking forward, which is a sustainable future in every way, economically, environmentally, equity, is a world in which we do not own cars, our own cars, but there's lots and lots of cars, but they're owned by a mobility service company.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be a company like Lyft or Uber. It could be Ford or GM. It could be a local nonprofit company as well. But they operate these vehicles. And we create various incentives so that they accommodate multiple people mm-hmm. in the vehicle. So the pooling part of it. And those vehicles are electric.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why that is such a desirable future is because these vehicles will be relatively cheap because you have no driver and you have multiple passengers.
Mm-hmm.
So the cost of being in a car will be much less than what it is today, even for our personally owned vehicles, mm-hmm. and far, far less than what Uber and Lyft charge right now. So therefore, you have a future in which there's very few emissions because it's electric, in which you've got a lot of pooling so that it reduces congestion and so on and sprawl. It's a future in which the cost is relatively low, so therefore people, anyone, can gain access to it. And maybe it will continue to subsidize probably low-income riders, but it won't cost us very much because the cost is...
So you don't have to subsidize so much.
So much, and you can subsidize a lot more people. Right now, our transit system does a very poor job of serving even low-income people.
Yes, yes.
It's really a small percentage in a small percentage of situations.
Okay, so let's take each one of those three elements and go in some greater depth to them. Electric. I own an electric car, so clearly I thought there was something good about an electric car. But I bought it even at a time of controversy when some people were saying, you shouldn't buy an electric car, you should buy an electric car. Well, this is what's bad. We don't know what's going to happen with the batteries and all of these kinds of issues. So can we definitively say on Office Hour today that question is settled and that electric cars are just a really good thing?
It is settled that almost all cars in the future will be electric.
Right.
The question is, you know, how soon will that be? And in different places, it'll be different. And the vehicles might be, some of them will be a plug-in hybrid, like the Chevy Volt.
Mm-hmm.
Or they might be pure electric, or they might be fuel cell electric running on hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
But they will be electric. There's so many reasons for it. Every car company is committed to it. They've got the technology. The battery costs are coming down at a really steep rate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a done deal that's going to happen, but... You know, we have this little problem in Washington, D.C.
Okay, well, we'll get back to the little problem. I just think it's really important to say that today because I've been saying that and people have been looking at me and very oddly. But around the corner, this family bought the little grocery store there. And we were asking them why they were starting this little grocery store. And the guy said because he had a car repair business and he didn't think there was much future in that. And therefore, he was going to sell groceries now. And I thought, oh, that fits right in my show when I'm talking with Dan. Because there's so little service on our car. And so there is this question of all those people who worked in car service. And I even heard a statistic recently that if you buy a regular gas car, it's decreasing in value much more quickly now than it did even 2 years ago. I don't know if you think this is true or not. Have we already got to the point where gas value of gas cars is just going down because of this switch being so imminent and people beginning to value the electric car so much?
Yeah, that's not so clear that's what's happening at this point. That will happen eventually. And you do have to remember California is not the world. We like to think it is or should be.
It isn't.
But we are moving faster towards electric vehicles. So like we're about 6-7% of new cars sold are electric in California. Mm-hmm. Over half of those are Teslas, by the way. The other companies, so that the problem we have is the other companies are lagging. So they've got the technology, they've got the supply chains, they've got all their suppliers in place. They're ready to do it, but they're waiting for two things. They're waiting for consumers to, you know, be more enthusiastic about buying them and be willing to pay for them. And they're waiting for stronger policy to support it. But they're ready to go, but they're lagging. So Tesla, I mean, you know, all these, you can always say things about Elon Musk or all of our innovative leaders, but what Tesla has done is remarkable. The success they've had in really getting us accustomed to the idea that an electric car really is a desirable thing and something to covet.
Well, we'll take a quick moment and I'll say I love my Bolt and that it's a great car. There's no looking back. And if we need to spread that enthusiasm, let's start spreading it right now. So here we are. We're officially spreading enthusiasm about the electric car. Now, the second part you were talking about was driverless vehicles. And I think that's something that's actually quite new. And if we're sort of, we can sort of grok to the idea of electric cars, right? But I think driverless vehicles is something that is quite difficult for many of us old people to understand. Though my son, I'll tell you, is a good example for you. He's never gotten a driver's license. He's 25. And he said to me, Mom, by the time I need to drive someone around, there will be driverless cars. So he's totally convinced he doesn't need to own a driver's license. And maybe the young people are more like that. But how do we understand these cars? They seem somewhat frightening in the news that you read about them. Help us understand this.
Well, journalists have to sell stories, right? And newspapers.
Right.
So anything goes wrong, hits the front page, right? So it gets a lot of attention. But if you look at it in a broader sense, like if there's a fire in a Tesla, big story. Someone gets killed by a driverless car, big story. But the reality is the technology is getting really improving at a very rapid rate. Now, is it ready for prime time now to really truly be a driverless? Probably not quite there yet. But it's getting there. You know, the technology is improving, the machine learning, the artificial intelligence, the hardware is all improving. And so when, you know, we'll have automated cars, we will have it in a limited way. Actually, in Davis campus, we had a little automated van running around in out in West Village where my office is and testing. They have to they go into training. You know, they're like kids, you know, they have to learn. So they have to what they do is they just basically map the hell out of an area so that every little they know where everything is, and you train them to how do you deal with bicyclists and dogs and so on. But they learn really fast. So when you know, that's hard to say. They will be available in probably a year or two in a very limited way. You know, the Tesla car is really, okay, let me put it this way. Almost every new car bought now has some amount of automation built into it. So adaptive cruise control. So actually now, more than any time in history, it really makes sense to buy a new car because there's so much new technology that goes into it. Adaptive cruise control is a good example and something I love. So you set the speed, you set how close you want to follow the car in front of you, and off you go. It accelerates and brakes. It stays a fixed distance behind the car in front of you up to the whatever maximum speed you set. And it's so relaxing. So I don't, actually, another story is I gave up my own cars, but I've been driving once in a while down I-5, and I just put it on this adaptive cruise control, and it's so relaxing because I don't have to worry about some truck stopping in front of me, and I have to be really alert. You know, I'm driving at above, you know, 70 miles per hour, and so it's much more relaxing, and that's just the beginning. And then there's technology that keeps the car in the lane, you know, that keeps mm-hmm. it in the lane. There's automatic emergency braking.
Exactly. In other words, that the machine can think faster than you can.
Oh, for sure.
So that's one way to think about it.
Think and act faster.
Think and act faster and maybe better. It might have drunk less the night before you got in the car.
But that's the story. The robots, they don't drink.
Yes.
They don't sleep. They don't get distracted.
They don't listen to music. They don't try to text. As far as we know, they don't text while they drive. So we're going to predict here today on the show that in 1 year, and years move fast, it feels like in the academic cycle, people will be buying driverless cars.
I have a neighbor, a young kid. You know, they don't always do things really smart, right? You know, and he has a well-to-do parent and gave him a Tesla with this autopilot. He was on I-5, he said, for 40 minutes. He fell asleep, and for 40 minutes that car drove on that freeway, and he's here to tell us about it.
And thank God that it was a Tesla, because 40 minutes of sleeping on a California highway otherwise is probably quite dangerous. So what is going to help people? It was very interesting, because we had a show that we did about bicycles, and it was kind of the same story, that when there is an accident around a bicycle, it tends to get a huge amount of press, and all of the miles of people bicycling without accidents are not reported. And what are the strategies to overcome that fear? We talked about trying to think about what makes people feel more secure on their bicycle so that they're not only just thinking about these accidents. So it's kind of the same thing in this case. That, we've heard about these accidents with self-driving cars. Is it simply going to be logging up more miles, or are there some other ways in which we're going to kind of make our sort of inner peace with driverless cars?
Well, okay, let's stick with bicycles for a moment, because that's one of my favorite topics. I lived in Berkeley many years, never rode a bicycle for all of the obvious reasons. Came to Davis, and I just ride everywhere. I love it. And the reason I do it is because it feels safe.
Yes.
And that's because Davis has built a network where you're separated from cars.
Yes.
You know, when I go to my office, I go under an arterial in a bike bridge. I go over a freeway on a bike bridge. And so I don't deal with cars for the most part. And I feel secure. Most places that are supposedly promoting bicycles, they put a stripe on the side of the road. And they give you a few feet of space, but you've got cars racing along right next to you. It scares the hell out of, you know, anyone that's, okay, I was going to say anyone that's not male and 25, but a young man in an audience recently reprimanded me.
You're saying that, okay.
So I won't say it quite so explicitly, but, you know, the rest of us need to feel safe. And with automated cars, I think it'll become pretty easy, because there are companies that are operating automated cars. They have someone in the car. They don't actually abandon the rider. So they have someone in the car to take over in case something goes wrong. But the people that are riding it, so the biggest program is in Phoenix in Arizona. And it's run by Google. The Waymo is the company. It's a Google company. And people feel, you interview them, they all say they feel comfortable and secure in it, you know, after a while. And so part of it is just experience. And mm-hmm. in the case of automated cars, in the case of bikes, we've got to build protected bike lanes, do a much better job than we have.
Mm-hmm. Are we going to change other things when we have more of these self-driving cars? Do they make, like you say, that having protected bicycle lanes changes everything? Are there going to be structural changes that we want to make with the way things work because of self-driving cars? Are they going to change lane patterns, or are they so adaptable that one of the advantages, we just can throw them right into the current traffic system of America and they'll be able to succeed?
Yeah, you can put them on the existing roads. I mean, eventually you can make the lanes narrower because, you know, they're driving automatically, and they'll be closer to each other, following each other more closely, because they're robots and they're smart and they react and they're communicating with all the other vehicles and they know what's going on. So the real point of that is we won't need more roads. We have more than enough roads. But the more important impact will be we won't need nearly as much parking all those parking garages, parking lots, shopping malls with these massive parking lots.
Well, you can't even find your car. That's what happens. You go there and you get lost.
Exactly. So most of that will go away. Uh-huh. And in fact, now I talk to city managers. They come to me and they say, okay, we're trying to make a decision whether to build a parking garage in our city. And we're curious whether that's a good idea. And, you know, the answer to that is eventually they will not need it. So what they're tending to do is, if there's really an urgent need, they build them, but they design them in a way that they can be converted to other uses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the explanation for that is that the cars are just been going around all the time, and therefore they don't need to be parked in a place. Or is it partly that the whole structure of where that they will be parked in different kinds of places, because they'll be parked presumably under some kind of relationship and dealt with through the companies that sponsor them?
Right. And it'll be outside the cities. So in an area where space is not a big issue, and they can be packed more compact, you know, parked more compactly because they're automated. But it's mostly that they won't need to be left at your office or in San Francisco or in Davis. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have it, you know, the vehicles, when they're not used, they'll be parked, you know, 5 miles outside of Davis, mm-hmm. for instance.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. Well, we have reached the end of the first segment of Office Hour today with Dan Sperling. So we will be back in just a few minutes. So in the meantime, stay tuned. Okay, welcome back to the second half of Office Hour today. And we are talking with Dan Sperling from the Department of Civil Engineering and Environmental Science and Policy. And we're talking about the three revolutions that are coming in transportation. One of them is the electric vehicles, and we talked about that. We put in our advertisement for that. And then we were talking about self-driving cars. So we're going to encourage everybody to, if you're feeling anxious about self-driving cars, one of the things we learned is that when you get in one and you ride around, you're going to like it. You're going to settle in pretty quickly to self-driving cars. That's the prediction.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, us humans, we think we're good drivers. But in fact, while certainly these robot cars are going to make mistakes because they might have been coded wrong or something goes wrong, but overall they're going to be far safer than we are.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's good, because I've actually, in my case, as I'm aging, I drive with aging drivers, and it is a terrifying thing, and I think many of them would be much better. Just people, my peers now, are terrible drivers, and I think we'd all do much better if we could just get out of our cars and have a self-driving car drive us.
Yeah, you know, we've been doing research, some of my colleagues here at Davis with some colleagues in Berkeley, and they look at, and they've actually took households and gave them a chauffeur as a way to simulate the effect of having an automated car. And which category of people do you think were the most enthusiastic in terms of changing their behavior and actually traveling more?
I wouldn't. The older people?
Older people.
People, right.
Because for just the reason you said, as you get older, you know, we get a little, our eyesight gets worse. We get decrepit, you know. We're afraid to drive at night.
But we still want to go places.
Exactly.
We still want to go places. Okay, well, I'm glad that's coming just as I age. On a very selfish note, I'm glad that self-driving cars are coming on just as I age out of my, which I really have already aged out of my really good driving years. So then the last question of them is this idea of sharing, which is, again, another, in many ways, not exactly an American value when it comes to things like cars and houses, which we think of as being sort of the, you know, the gold standard. You own your own home. You have two car garage. And you have to, that's what Davis requires you to have, parking for two cars. That's the expectation, that everybody will have their two cars. So, but yet we've seen a pretty fast adoption, at least by some parts of society, of what you call ride hailing. I love that, because it isn't actually hailing it. You're not hailing it, but it's ordering it on an app usually. That's actually been increasing. Despite the sort of myths of car ownership, the apps have been incredibly successful. So where are we now in terms of app use?
Yeah, you know, so some of us that are a little older, we used to do hitchhiking, right?
Yes.
And we'd get in a stranger's car.
Yes.
But even 10 years ago, who would have imagined that so many of us would be so comfortable just getting in a stranger's car?
Yes.
Right? And so it's really changed. And that's why I call these revolutions, because they're happening so quickly. And but the electric vehicles, the automation, the sharing, all happening quickly. And so this, you know, this ride pooling, ride sharing, really, it just got started 7 or 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just commonplace. When I do talks and with audiences, both community groups as well as professionals, I ask how many people use Uber or Lyft. It's like 80-90% of the people in the audience.
Is that true in America? You know, in other words, there's probably some demographics that use it much more than others.
Yeah. So that's true of professional people, because they use it to go to airports and things like that. And it's true in California cities, because Uber and Lyft got started in San Francisco.
Right.
And so it's very common there in Los Angeles. It's less true in other cities as outside California. But in major cities, it's pretty common.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about it. You know, we get in the stranger's car, but we do it because it's so compelling. You don't have to worry about paying a tip, or you don't even have to talk to the driver if you don't want to. Everything is handled financially, seamlessly. And you just press that button and you can see where the car is.
Yes.
You know, think of a taxi cab. You call them, you have no idea when they're going to show up, even if they're going to show up. And so it's really gotten us accustomed to a whole another type of service.
Yes, and the idea is that if you weigh that anxiety about not knowing the person and how their driving record, their value, their car or whatever, there's so many other conveniences, you say, that I don't think people generally are, even though there are stories about this as well. Obviously, there are stories about it going very wrong, and you do read those stories. But yet, I think it's widely accepted, certainly among young people. I think of my children both doing it at 25 and 27. They are totally into that world. So we've kind of gotten used to that. And interestingly, we've also seen that abroad. We did quite a bit of using of Lyft when we were in and Uber in places in South Africa and other places around the world. So it's not just Northern California. It's really all over the whole world. So can you give us some statistics on how many rides or what percentage of rides are now from ride-hailing apps?
So in the United States, so China actually is the biggest user of it in the world. But in the United States, now there's about 1% 1% of trips, but that's about how many people use buses. Mm-hmm. So about the same number of people use Lyft and Uber as use buses, but it's still only about 1% of trips. So there's huge opportunity for, you know, big increases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But here again, the question becomes that, as many people have pointed out, the preliminary introduction of Lyft and Uber has not decreased traffic. So here again, when we're talking about your revolutions, there has to be a particular way in which Lyft and Uber are used in order to help us meet that wonderful future.
Yes, revolution number three. You got it. And that's exactly. So in fact, Uber and Lyft actually increase congestion.
Yes.
Right now, because what's happening, you take San Francisco, kind of a worst case scenario, is it's already congested. And what's happening is people are, you know, using the Lyft and Uber, but they're just doing it most of the time as a single passenger. And these Lyft and Uber cars, they have to circle around. You know, it takes time to, you know, distance to get to where you're going.
Yeah.
Some of these people would have used transit instead.
Mm-hmm.
So the net effect is an increase in what we call vehicle miles traveled. But the point of that is, we need to get people to share. So the idea, so Uber Pool and Lyft Share actually are these services where multiple people get in the same car. That's only a few years old. And
so, that's the future.
And that's the future.
Okay. So the future is getting in a car with somebody you don't know, or getting in a car that drives itself, and getting in the car with other people you don't know.
Correct.
And that's also part of it, that I imagine, again, will take sort of a change of our minds about how we see transportation. because I think people aren't, that may be one reason why people don't ride buses more than they do. Having been on the buses recently, buses are there's such crazy things happen on buses, and you don't know who else is going to be on the bus. Now we're going to be doing that in terms of cars as well. But we're going to do it, you predict, because so many other values are going to outweigh whatever we feel about getting in a car with two or three people we don't know.
Yeah, you get the benefit of equity because you're giving access to people that don't have good mobility now. So that's something as a society we're going to embrace. It's going to be good for the environment, something as a society we're going to embrace. And all those people that voted for mass transit, money for mass transit, they're going to embrace it, even though they might be reluctant to actually use it themselves. They'll be supportive of it for the same reason. At the end of the day, the biggest thing is just going to be much cheaper.
It's going to be save you so much money that's also going to be a big motivation to get in there. And one day, all that time you were wishing that your neighbor was on a bus and your neighbor was wishing that you were on a bus. And one day this Uber or Lyft is going to pull up in front of your house and you're both going to get in it. And finally, you and your neighbor are going to be doing the same thing and they will have gotten you out of your individual cars. Is that the story that you're...
That is the story. So we'll have to lure people in, and that's where policy comes in. We've got to create the incentives that make it more attractive and cheaper to share rides, to pool rides, and more expensive and less convenient if you're going to own your own car or be a single passenger. So as I tell people, everyone's got a price, okay? So,
yes.
Some of us are going perhaps more affluent and more resistant for whatever reason. So we'll be laggards, but others of us will be more price sensitive, and some of us will be quite comfortable. In fact, I use Lyft and Uber a lot, and many of the drivers are doing it for the sociability of it.
Yes.
Especially retired older people. They say, I get a little pocket change and I get out of the house. I drive a few hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
So, we have to understand and appreciate that people are so diverse and there is no average person. So if we start off with just 5 or 10% of the people using it.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Particularly using those sharing. Do you have any concerns about all the discussions we hear about the gig economy and therefore the question of whether the people who are employed in these systems like Uber and Lyft have the same upward mobility that in the old days a bus driver would have? Some bus drivers ending up being fairly well paid and having unionization and all of those protections that Lyft and Uber drivers don't have. Do you see that as a problem that will somehow solve itself as we solve other problems?
Well, we have created this whole new job category of Uber and Lyft drivers. That didn't exist 10 years ago. But yeah, there's a lot of people doing it now. But this is a good news story, actually, because, okay, I know I'm a little bit of an optimist here, but actually, if you think it through, we're talking about a future of automated vehicles in which there will be many more jobs. Now, they won't be the same jobs, and there'll be the disruptions that come with it, and the role of government is to smooth these disruptions, but there will be more jobs because, think of it this way, now about 3 or 4% of our trips are chauffeured, and when I say that, I mean taxis, trains, buses, Lyft and Uber, and what we're talking about is taking that 3 or 4% up to 30 or 60 or 80%.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're doing is taking an activity which now is uncompensated. We drive our own cars, right?
Right.
No one's paying us. No one's employed. And now we're going to start paying companies to transport us. And so what that's going to do is mean there's going to be this whole new industry of companies, like think of Uber and Lyft on steroids. But, as I said, it could be nonprofit companies, it could be the car companies. And there's going to be a lot of them. So there'll be all these businesses and there'll be people that own the businesses, the accountants, the engineers, the computer scientists, but also customer care people. And so, almost any way you look at it.
There's new jobs.
There's new jobs.
And maybe less stressful jobs. Maybe some of them will be better jobs. Do you see this actually as being something that the nonprofit world, I mean, that's a very utopian moment that the nonprofit world would, could actually mobilize around, as opposed to it simply being, you know, certain people who have their, like Elon Musk, people who have the capacity and the vision to organize themselves to capture all of this potential growth?
That I'm not so sure, but I think the possibility exists, and probably more so in the smaller cities and the rural areas, because then there'll be less profit potential, less revenue there for the bigger companies. But there's a lot of opportunity for communities to organize. So the city of Davis could say, we want to support local nonprofits, community companies to serve our community, and can make it, you know, provide the incentives to do that. I hope that's what happens.
Well, I can imagine you hope that happens. Are there any examples of what you would say of success, or what are your examples of who's doing the best job of imagining and trying to bring this future upon us now? And then we can also talk about who you think is doing the worst job of imagining our future. But who do you really see as your models these days? You mentioned Phoenix is doing important stuff as a city.
Well, what Phoenix is doing is not imposing many rules and regulations on companies. So I'm not sure that's exactly the model.
Mm.
But they're going there because it's relatively easy. Mm-hmm. The weather is good. It's flat. There's not very many people.
Ah,
so it's a good
test case.
It's a good test case. Actually, so there's different pieces of this.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, a lot of European cities are doing the best in terms of trying to figure out how to accommodate people in a way that is less environmentally impactful and less has less equity, negative equity impacts. So you do see cities like Stockholm and even Paris that are doing a lot to encourage bicycles and,
yes,
and creating more bike lanes and improving their transit and electric cars, and they're closing off streets gradually. Copenhagen's a good example of that. And a lot of the Dutch cities where bicycling is really, it's like Davis,
mm-hmm,
except in big cities. The U.S. cities, we've been built around the car. It's really hard. It's going to be tougher here. And that's why the idea of these mobility service companies where they're accommodating people, where they're pooling rides, combined with supporting bikes and scooters for local trips.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really what we're hoping for or aiming towards in the U.S. cities.
Mm-hmm. Having lots of options so that they have, because you don't know where people are going, what connectors they're missing. Maybe they can fill it in with a scooter. Maybe they can fill it in with a bicycle. Maybe they can fill it in with a little extra, a lift ride, and then they'll use public transportation. Sort of like a smorgasbord of all kinds of things that you imagine.
Yes. My number one strategy going forward is to increase choice.
Because
now we don't have choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a little bit of transit, and we rely on our cars. Most of us, we get in the morning, we wake up, you don't even think about how you're going to get somewhere. You just automatically walk out to the car in the driveway, get in the car and drive off. And it's going to be very difficult to get away from that. But that is what we need to get away from. And indeed, so the first step in that is creating choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had that choice. I walked out of my house about 3 days ago and someone had left one of the scooters in front of my house. And I didn't see who it was. I don't know how it got there. But it was like this sort of mysterious gift left right there and saying like, well, Professor Janowitz, maybe today you just want to take a scooter, which, of course, I was on my way to Amtrak. So I didn't think I could actually take a scooter to Amtrak. But it was, I felt like, it's funny, you know, those of us who are historians, we often are told that there's this thing called a watershed, some great moment in the past when society changed. And I've always wanted to sort of to see a watershed. And I sort of feel in this discussion like we may actually be part right now. This is a watershed, and that maybe we don't all see it as much because we know there are electric cars. We find a scooter outside. but that we are sort of at a watershed moment in American society.
Yeah. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, almost none of this existed. This mm-hmm. is really new, and it has the potential truly to be revolutionary, how we get around.
Well, what we want to know as historians when we come to a watershed moment is what makes a watershed moment. So what do you think was really the, you know, how if you step back from it, what will they say in 100 years from now? Was it simply that kind of innovation that goes on in California? Was it a few sort of forethinking individuals who imagined a different future? Was it, I can't imagine the answer is going to be that it was environmental concern, because I'm not sure, even though this is something we talk about at Davis, it's not clear. What do you think brought us to this watershed?
The iPhone and apps. That was the enabling technology, because basically it means you can leave a scooter anywhere you want, and the next person can look at their phone and know where the scooter is that they want to get a scooter. It makes possible Uber and Lyft could not exist. We talked earlier about carpooling. Carpooling died because the transaction costs were so hard. You and I were in a carpool, a van pool, and it was really inconvenient.
Yes.
Right? And everyone had to leave at exactly the same time. And we had rules. You couldn't talk after a certain time, and you couldn't wear perfume or cologne because people were allergic.
And getting there was annoying for me. I had to walk to the BART and then take the BART. And that's why I was already annoyed before I even got to the carpool.
Right.
Right. And so it's all about the iPhone.
Well, that's the enabling technology that made it all possible. And the rest of it is, I mean, there's other technologies. The automation technologies, of course, are important for automation. But it's mostly, the other part of it is behavioral.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to become comfortable getting in a car with a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get comfortable riding a scooter, you know, or bike, you know, somewhere. And we have to get comfortable with sharing pooling rides.
Mm-hmm.
And that, we're getting started. A lot of people that use the Uber and Lyft, they say about 20 to 30% of the people that, where it's available, they actually press that button to do it. And sometimes they're gaming it, hoping no one else will get in it.
Yes.
But a lot of people, they're price sensitive. Because the reality is Lyft and Uber are expensive.
They're price sensitive, and they know they're going to spend the day in a cafe not talking to anybody, working on their computer with the people next to them not talking to them. So they figure on my way to the cafe is my great chance in the car to actually talk to somebody. So I do wonder, because I see the isolation that so many of my students I feel live in, that there may actually be the idea that you are interested in who are the other people in the car, and you might even see that as an added plus. So what are the...
A few of us.
A few of us.
A few of us are price sensitive. A few of us are sociable.
So I don't know if it's worthwhile spending... We don't have a lot of time left, but to talk about, we were saying the success is what are the problems? And obviously, probably the main problem is the government at this point and the particular stance that's been taken and trying to roll back all the kinds of things that you're talking about. So do you want to give us a short version of the bad news?
Well, that's really just a little glitch. You know, the Trump administration is trying to get rid of greenhouse gas standards, fuel economy standards, or at least roll them back and take away California's right to adopt its own electric vehicle requirements and policies. But it's really just a glitch.
It's just a glitch. Okay, that's what I'm going to tell people. Say, it's just a glitch out there, everybody, what's going on today in America. It's just a glitch, and we're going to get over it.
In this case, I'm comfortable saying it's a glitch because Europe is going ahead much faster than us. China is going ahead much faster than us. Japan is going ahead faster, so at least on electric vehicles. And so that part of it, yes, it's unfortunate, but it's not a showstopper.
Okay. So then if you were telling people who are listening to the show who want to, they can certainly read your articles and learn more in that way. The big moves for them would be simple changes, like when you open your Lyft or your Uber app to hit the share button. That's like the frontier. That's the new California frontier for environmentalists listening to the show.
Yes, correct. The other one is using a scooter or bike for short trips instead of getting in a car.
And maybe you want to talk about, for those of you out there who are ready for the next level, for the graduate school version of this, if you're already sharing on Lyft, say a little bit about giving up the car. You now live a carless society life. So you're sort of a model for our society of somebody who doesn't have a car at all. Right. And what's that been like for you?
Yeah, my wife told me I had to walk the talk. So and so I have done it because I believe it. I wanted to do it. But I also am doing it to appreciate and understand what are the challenges. And there are challenges. It's probably easier in Davis than almost anywhere because I can ride a bike almost anywhere. I can walk safely. It doesn't rain very much. So it works pretty well. And then when I'm going somewhere to the airport or Sacramento, I can take a train. I can take a train to Sacramento or to the Bay Area, which I do. But I'll use Lyft or Uber. For a lot of trips as well. I have